Welcome to the Daily Canon Podcast. Here to talk all things Arsenal is your host, Matthew Wade.
Hello again, listeners, and welcome to another Daily Canon Weekly Podcast. Joining me this week to talk about a slightly different range of issues to what we normally talk about, given that there's been no Arsenal games, but there are other things of great significance going on in the world of football, the Premier League, and that will affect Arsenal directly, is Stephen Bradley, hot off his radio show. How are you, Stephen?
Not too bad. I'd be lying if I said I had a 9-to-5 job that worked me into calluses in my hands, but no, it's not too bad. Yeah, 2-6 live on Midlands 103, me and Will O'Callaghan. They're a cheap plug for you. But yeah,
like it's on your vocal cords instead.
Yeah, unfortunately. No Guinness tonight to ease them out and ease them into relaxation either. But no, it's been one of those weeks where even though there's been very little Arsenal news, I know, you know, the Arsenal women spanked Everton again with nothing but long-range screamers again. Like, we've got the best striker in the world and we're scoring all our goals from 30 yards. There ain't more Arsenal than that. but with the news that we'll talk about in a second, with Newcastle, like, it does affect Arsenal. It absolutely affects Arsenal. And probably the two most politically-minded podcast members, maybe discounting Paul Williams a touch, but, you know, this is a subject that absolutely involves Arsenal in more ways than just money. So, yes. You know, let's discuss how and why.
Yeah. I mean, obviously the news is fully out there. It's been discussed a fair bit already. The Newcastle takeover with the Saudi Public Investment Fund passing the Premier League's extremely strenuous fit and proper persons test, which, I'd love to see that. I bet it's a shitload easier than the English citizenship test, British citizenship test. I mean, obviously, there's so many different angles to discuss this from. I mean, the most obvious is the enormous amounts of money involved. I mean, yes, they spent £300 million. I mean, Mike Ashley might have sold it for £300, but yeah. £300 million on Newcastle, which has probably made Mike Ashley a very happy man. Got all his money invested back and a little bit more as a sweetener. But this is an organisation that has £300 billion at its disposal and suddenly makes all other rich owners in the Premier League look like small fry. It certainly makes the Emirates investment in Man City pale into insignificance, you know, in terms of what's possible, and makes our own billionaire property magnate, if you want to call him that, seem almost irrelevant in financial terms. It's sort of more of the same, but also very new territory as well, because, you know, we don't know exactly how they're going to handle it. There's a suggestion that they're not going to could go on a mad splurge all at once, but we're talking resources beyond even the imagination, really, and you know, I suppose we had Man City, we had Abramovich, we had PSG, but this is another ballpark. I mean, before we get into moral and political and even footballing issues, just what's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that's maybe not the biggest concern, but in terms of just sporting integrity, that's the biggest concern. Is that when Roman Abramovich bought Chelsea in the middle of 2003, we were like, oh, he could spend any amount. But we knew really he couldn't. You know, we knew there was a limit because there's only so much one man can spend. And yes, he has spent £1 billion in Chelsea in the last 18 years. And yes, it is all down as loans. However, Chelsea were worth literally £1 when he bought him and they're worth £2 billion now. Mm. So you could legitimately write that off as an investment a man has made. And this capitalistic prick is not going to criticize that, unfortunately. It's one of those ones where it's like, yes, has he ruined football? No. You know, Chelsea, when was the last time Chelsea, like the first time Chelsea bought someone that Arsenal could have bought was Eden Hazard. But after that, like Chelsea have never really bought anyone that's out of Arsenal's range ever, really. Like considering the fact that Arsenal spent €80 million on Pepe. You know, like now Chelsea
right over however many years that might be in okay,
but,
style.
but they did it.
Yeah, indeed.
Right? There's still that sense that Arsenal, as much money as they have had, they're still not going to be able to compete with the likes of Manchester United, the likes of Real Madrid, the likes of Bayern Munich, well, maybe Bayern Munich, but the likes of Barcelona, least over the last couple, before the last couple of years, just because they have more money than us. It's just the fact, it's just the way it is. And seeing Chelsea have as much money as Manchester United didn't really, it was annoying that Chelsea would turn from nothing into a perennial superpower, but it was the fact that, look, it's a London club, it's a Russian billionaire, he's bought it literally to save his own life, literally.
Yes.
Life sometimes gets in the way, and fine. When Man City bought, when Man City were bought by Abu Dhabi, basically, it was the first sense of, ah, okay, a government is literally stepping in to sports wash itself, is the term it's given, to make younger, yeah, to make younger people especially equivalent Manchester City with Abu Dhabi, and winning with Abu Dhabi, and prestige, and whatever comes with buying Jack Grealish and Carlos Tevez and Sergio Aguero and Yaya Toure and etc. etc. And, you know, like I said, literally wipe any other impression from people's mind. And
well, there's another angle there which I just want to jump into now because it's less important, but I think it's also relevant before you continue with that one. Is the whole issue with Man City was the FFP dodging and the Etihad sponsorship, but one has to say,
yeah,
long term, that sponsorship deal has been worth it for Etihad, because that was a brand that no one knew a thing about, no one really was interested in, and suddenly they are, everyone knows the brand now, and they are ubiquitous with Manchester City and that success, and the whole broader investment as well. So it's actually been doubly effective strategically from their perspective, sports washing, but also actually generating a boost for state industry. Sorry, I just wanted to get back to you.
And to be fair, the Manchester area where Manchester City, you know, Manchester City's stadium is still council owned. It's the, and Abu Dhabi have built a lot of infrastructure in the square mile around that stadium to the point where it is now a council asset to have, you know, 12-15 AstroTurf pitches, 12-15 natural turf pitches, facilities, gyms, swimming pools. Like, they have done a lot for the area. That cannot be, you know, written off either. And yes, they're, you know, spending $100 million on Jack Grealish, but they've spent more on the area. It's not just on the team. So there is that too. And the league has been bought before. Jack Walker did it with Blackburn. Nobody cared.
Very different scenario, though, because Jack Walker was, he was the archetypal local man made good, and something that was actually had been a tradition within British football and indeed European football as a whole for quite a long time. You know, whether that's the Agnelli's in Juventus, for instance, but it's a local business. Someone buys the club, puts money into it. They're rich, but they're not unfathomably rich. And ultimately, you know that it almost becomes a family club in a way, and it's a family steeped in the area, in the same way that, again, Juventus Turin, every local car is a bloody Fiat. There's a reason for that. It's an investment for them, but it's also them putting a lot of money in to doing something that they dream for their home, which has a hugely different emotional resonance with all of us.
Yes, and that's the problem. Yeah. Like, you can write off Jack Walker and say, look, Jack Walker bought Blackburn because they're his club. And he's like, right, okay, I'm going to buy Alan Shearer. I'm going to buy Chris Sutton. I'm going to buy Stuart Ripley. And, you know, we're going to try and, you know, do well. I'm going to bring in Kenny Dalglish's manager, you know, and they won the league, you know, and then fought with each other in the Champions League next year, which is hilarious. But we almost allow that, like, in our sense of, in our constantly changing sense of morality when it comes to football, that's allowed, because that's what I would do if I had a few billion quid. I'd buy Arsenal and I'd splunk a feck ton of money on it. So I want the chance, maybe. It's the American dream, I know, and it's, but that's what I'd like to do. So I'm not going to criticize someone else for doing it, even though it's not my club.
Well, it's also, Jack Walker was a situation where there was a big splurge of investment, transferred Blackburn from a perennial second tier team to the British League champions, but there was not the sort of sums of money involved which could really make us a major long-term game-changing aspect. He bought his team a title because basically they hadn't won it for 100 years.
Yeah.
But it was never going to change the landscape of the competitive environment. It was like it was like a little blip, lovely for the supporters of the team, lovely for the town, lovely for him. And everyone's kind of like, yeah, like you say, that's what I would do. But also the impact on others is extremely short-lived.
Yes,
the crucial
and this is where the line is drawn, because the line is drawn And you can it, you can mark the date. It's exactly when PSG basically took a £222 million check out of the Qatar National Bank, brought it to Barcelona, brought it to the league offices and said, here, we're taking Neymar.
Yeah, and there's nothing you can do about it.
And there's nothing you can do about it. And they did that for the sole purpose of trying to bankrupt Barcelona. And it worked. It worked almost too well. You know, like they said, look, we're going to inflate the market prices so that only we can afford them. And for 2 years it worked. And now Barcelona are dead broke. And what they lose, they lost €481 million last year.
Yeah.
Like that was their plan. And that's the first sense of, they're trying to literally break the system so that only they can benefit from it. Like Man City, again, they were bending very, very, they weren't breaking FFP, but they were bending it over their knee quite substantially.
Well, and yeah, I mean, you can't say they're breaking it because otherwise their fleet of £1 billion lawyers will come.
Yes. As you can tell, I was on live radio half an hour. My lawyer's hat is still on. But they were at least trying to have.
And even if there's lawyers, then he got off on a technicality. Let's not let that slip.
So they were at least trying to play by the rules that had already been set, especially the unwritten rules. Qatar basically went one step further and went, we kind of care, but we don't really. We just want to be seen as the best team in the world. That's it. And if that means we have to spend over the odds to get Neymar, Mbappe and Messi at the club, we don't care. And now they have them. The public investment fund, because we have to legally state that this is not being owned by Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman.
Although he is their chairman.
He's their chairman, but it's the Saudi Public Investment Fund that is basically bankrolling this. And because it has 10 times the amount of money that the Qatari owners have and the Abu Dhabi owners have, it means that there is no recourse. They're not going to spend $300 billion on Newcastle. Let's be realistic here. But they could spend every penny that has ever been spent in football and lose it all and not care. And that's the problem. This is a step above anything and everything we've ever seen in an attempt to sports wash themselves, like we said earlier. And as a result, Newcastle now will be flooded, both literally and physically, with money. Like, they are going to pump money into this club. They're going to, every big name, even every medium-sized name, is going to be linked with Newcastle for the next 5 years. And as a result, Arsenal now not only have to worry about Man City being able to overpay any wages that Arsenal can pay because they have foreign money, but now Newcastle are going to be able to pay and outpay Arsenal or maybe anyone else for no good reason other than foreign money. And that's the problem. And as a result, it's harder and harder to justify Mikel Arteta's performance and say, well, he's not going to win the league with this team, because now you're looking at it and going, well, how is he going to win the league? Like, if he wins the league and City have spent $100 million on Jack Grealish and maybe spend another $100 million on Harry Kane in the summer, and then Newcastle respond with, well, we've got $400 million in our transfer kitty. And Manchester United, if they don't win the league, goes, well, we're gonna bring in a new manager and he's going to spend another $100 million on a midfielder. And if Chelsea don't win the league and they say, well, we're going to spend another... Like, at some point, you have to look at it, and maybe this is just Arsenal fans not turning into, but realizing what Everton fans and Newcastle fans before this and Villa fans knew and every other mid-table Premier League club, and they're like, well, we're not going to get in the top four because Arsenal will outspend us and Tottenham will outspend us.
But the key difference there is previously, Arsenal would outspend us by a few million quid.
Yeah.
By very small margins. And actually, apart from a brief stint at the start of Herbert Chapman's time in charge of Arsenal back in the 20s, late 20s, early 30s, and very recently, Arsenal have actually been one of the lowest spending clubs of the really big clubs. Mm. It's until maybe 3 years ago, 4 years ago, Arsenal were being outspent year on year by Everton, Spurs, yeah. You know, all these other teams. And so, and it was actually that it was still much more dependent on the size of the club and the tradition of the club, and that it's been built up over a 100-year period. And that's that's another key difference here, is it's, you don't want to say, I mean, I think it's also important to say actually at this point that we don't begrudge the happiness that Newcastle fans feel in any way, shape, or form. You know, they've had an owner who they've had no connection to, who bought the club as an investment, then realised, oh shit, this is a lot harder than I thought, and then basically has done nothing apart from the bare minimum to secure the value of that investment and has not really been engaged at all.
Yeah.
So, of course, they're delighted. They'd take anyone to get rid of Mike Ashley. And also, they're a club that is massively underachieved for its size. And no one, I think, a bit like when it first came to Man City, you know, most of us were quite happy for Man City fans because they'd had the piss ripped out of them for years and years and years, despite being a massive club with there's actually a good fan environment as well. So that's something I want to make really clear that, and also where we're in the same boat, our relationship's a bit more complicated. We can't equate how we'd feel about it as Arsenal fans to Newcastle, because we've all had, it's a while ago now, but we've all had the amazing teams, the winning trophies, the some of the world's best players, you know, more than one every 10 years or every 20 years. So it's very hard for us to kind of put ourselves in their shoes. So I'm never going to criticise the Newcastle fans. And this kind of idea that's been floating around that the Newcastle fans should take some moral opposition to stop this happening. I mean, one, what the hell could they do? Nothing, frankly.
Nothing. Yes.
But secondly, also, why should they? It's not up to them to police Premier League football or European football. You know, the fact that the public investment fund, and we'll get more onto the regime behind it, have done this, is the fault of that lies with years of inaction from the football institutions who have just been chasing the money. And of course, chasing the money has grown the Premier League and has made it the best league in the world. So you have to excuse that to a degree, but it was done with such a lack of foresight. And as you make very clear, Jack Walker's one thing. Abramovich, okay, it's a bit of a game changer, but it's still a very different situation. But as soon as you got state-funded organisations or essentially states coming in and buying clubs, that completely changes the landscape, not just because of the size of the resources, not just because of their aims for doing it, why they're doing it, but also because you are now essentially selling your game, your sport, as a political tool for another entity, which always means that others are going to want to get involved, because no one, you know, the other Middle Eastern states were never going to let the United Arab Emirates be the only, Abu Dhabi, be the only player at the table. And then when Qatar got joined, but no, you know, the other Arab states are not going to. They see what's happening. They're not going to let it. And then where does it continue after that? Okay, so then you've got Saudi Arabia. Who else might get involved? You know, how long before? Yeah. You know, and you know, could something that was vaguely set up by Vladimir Putin pass the fit and proper persons test? Or China? We know about Chinese stealth investment all over the world. You know, they're quite open about it in Africa, but in, you know, we've seen the way they've been buying up gold reserves. And we have basically allowed football, and particularly in the Premier League, to become a political tool rather than a sport. And we can look at this situation and be alarmed from both a sporting perspective, an Arsenal perspective, and a humanitarian perspective. But it's amazing how little noise there was when Man City was bought.
Yeah, and the concept of sports washing wasn't really developed at that point. Like there was bits and pieces, you know, that you'd seen places trying to bring in, you know, Formula One Grand Prix and big fights and something like that. But that, it was almost like small fry. It's like, okay, they've got a small bit of, they're trying to flout their money, but this is completely different. Like when Qatar won the rights to the 2022 World Cup, everyone knows that's crooked. Everyone knows they bought it. Like, and to the point where it's like, we can see what they're trying to do now. And the reason why the Saudi Arabian bid for Newcastle was accepted this week was not because their money was good. It was accepted because BOUTQ, which is the Saudi Arabian pirate station that has been robbing BeIN Sports, has basically said, sorry. Yeah. Our bad. We're going to stop now. We really apologize. Here's £1 billion.
Yeah.
And then 36 hours later, the Premier League announces that suddenly Amanda Staveley does have the $305 million available to her to buy Newcastle United. Like, it's such a front. It's pure and simple. And it's like saying that, oh no, the person himself is bad, but the money's clean. Money's good. So now, not that we're money laundering, but we're not doing much more. And it's all for one thing. It's all for one thing and one thing only, to make Mohamed bin Salman look good. That's it. No other reason. Because again, he has seen how well it has worked for Abu Dhabi and Qatar in the last 10 years, where Qatar is now associated with Neymar more than it is with slave labor.
Yeah,
it's as simple as that. 10 years ago, slave labor, human rights, everything. Ask anyone under 25, Qatar, or PSG, Mbappe. That's it. That's all they know. Abu Dhabi, Man City. That's it. Maybe the Grand Prix.
Of course, we have to, as Arsenal fans, recognise that we were one of the first experiments in very low-level sports washing from Middle Eastern states. And as we talked about it on, I think it was episode 164 of the Daily Cannon podcast, do go and find it on the archives if you can, because it's well worth a listen. We spoke to, we had a very long interview with basically a humanitarian organisation involved in human rights, trying to prevent human rights abuses in the UAE.
Visit Rwanda on our fecking shirts, for God's sake.
Well, that's it. I mean, the situation in Rwanda is more complicated, though. I will say that there isn't the it's a bit more fluid, a bit more. That's partly about also dealing with perception that isn't entirely justified as well as perception that is. But yeah, I mean, but we've taken the oil money because we needed it to build a new stadium, and now everyone. I mean, if you did a pop quiz, I wonder how many people listening to this podcast would be able to tell you what the original name of the Arsenal Stadium was before its sponsorship deal.
Good old Ashburton Grove.
Which is not particularly catchy, and you can see why the other one stuck so much. But it's
no. But when we renegotiated the deal for the image rights of the stadium and the kit, the image rights were thrown in as free for the stadium because everyone now refers to it as the Emirates Stadium. Like, where did Bolton play?
Well, it's the Reebok, isn't it?
No, it hasn't been Reebok for 15 years.
I don't actually know what the Bolton Stadium
is. I think it's the University of Bolton Stadium. I think they're sponsored. Okay. But my point stands. Everyone calls it the Reebok. The Wigan Athletic haven't played at the JJB for a decade. Like, it's stuff like that. So that's what you're buying.
So what you've got to do is you've got to make sure you sponsor a team when they're good. And then when they're shit. Yes.
Yeah. When they're building the stadium, which is why Tottenham Hotspur's stadium is still the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium.
Yeah.
Because they don't want to name it anything until they've sold the rights. Because if they name it something, then it'll catch on, and then the rights are worth shit.
Yeah.
You know. So like, it's like that's again, PR and all that jazz at play. And it's just the fact that when the deal went through, and then the other 19 Premier League clubs went, hang on. We didn't think this was going to go through imminently. Who said this was a good idea? And we're like, you did. These are your rules. What the hell? Why are you complaining now? And it maybe it's just a sense of they didn't think it was going to go through. And now it has. Now they're realizing, well, hang on a minute. Like, okay, Manchester United. Say someone buys Manchester United just because they're a Manchester United fan and they're worth 20 billion. And they're like, look, Glazers, feck off. Here's your £4 billion. I'm going to live off Manchester United for the rest of my life. I'll take a dividend of £1 million a year. It'll literally be my pension. And every penny Manchester United makes goes into the club. So they have £200 million to spend a year, which is roughly what they could do. Even they would be outspent by the Saudis by a ratio of maybe 3 or 4 to 1 a year, easily. And it wouldn't bother this investment fund a jot. And that's the problem.
The real problem is as we saw with PSG, the transfer and wage market inflation that had been spawned by Abramovich and then by Man City and then by the Spanish giants had finally settled down to a period of leveling off. And then PSG came in and went, no, actually, we're going to lift the market to a level that we're going to try and stop anyone else being able to compete with us. But of course, if you play that game, there's always a bigger fish. and a very, very, very large
and
fish
here it is
into the waters.
In walks a blue whale.
And the Saudi PIF can basically, if they choose to, because I can't imagine UEFA's teeth will stand up very strongly in the face of the amounts of money involved. If they choose to, they can basically make it impossible for any other team to compete with them on transfers on any financial aspect, which would also mean that it would force up the wages and transfers across the board as well. So someone, you know, you could ask the hypothetical question, you know, if they bid £120 million for Bukayo Saka, should we take it? But then what do we do with that money if the market's been inflated to the level that the impact of that would have? We would be able to buy, you know, a couple of people that aren't as good. You'd be playing Pepe prices all round. That's terrifying for the stability and safety of football clubs as well.
But you know what that's going to do? So the Super League is now back. Super League's going to come back.
Yeah.
And it was going to be 18 teams. Now they're going to find room for two more.
Yeah.
And one of them is going to be Newcastle.
Yeah.
I don't know who the other one will be, but they're going to say, right, okay, we're going to set up a league. This is all you can spend. You want in? You can build up your team, get it up to our level, no problem. After that, we're on equal standing. That's what they'll do. And Newcastle will accept. Instantly accept.
Yeah, because then they're in there.
They've got a golden ticket. They're in. They're in. They're at the table. Yeah. And immediately, they're one of the biggest 20 clubs in the world. And that might be what maybe gets UEFA in on it. Because what if the PIF comes up and says, right, okay, Man City say, go to Tottenham and say, right, here's 100 million. And Newcastle United go to Harry Kane and say, right, you want to be at a club that spends money? You want to be, we need English players because we still have to have 8 homegrown players. We're going to give Tottenham 200 million. Right, we're going to give you £600,000 a week. We're going to give you an out. We're going to make you the focal point of our new status. You're going to be the next Alan Shearer, literally. You can go up here. We're going to give you the number 9. You will be our focal point. We're going to build around you. Who says no? Yeah, but that's the thing, like. Now, that is absolutely 100% in play. Because Harry Kane can go, look, it's too much money. Tottenham can go, well, we wanted to be able to reinvest the money in other places of the team. We weren't settling for anything less than this. Newcastle have handed us this in used £20 notes. Why not? And it suits everyone. And, well, it suits everyone on a PR scale. Mm. And like I said, that's Newcastle's first. That's their first, you know, to coin David Dean, that's their first shot of £50 notes across the bow. Mm-hmm. You know, like they buy the England captain. Instant recognition, instant news, instant statement made. We're here. We're not breaking FFP because we spent feck all.
Because Mike has done a very good job of giving us lots of FFP flexibility for the next 5 years.
Because our profits have been going up and up and up, and we've spent nothing. Like, so, like that, if I was them, that'd be play number one. Go to Tottenham in January and say, look, how much?
Yeah.
And if it's 150, 160 grand, here.
Yeah.
Give Tottenham an out, give Kane an out, and say, and immediately, whoever's wearing number 9 at Newcastle, go to them and say, look. And then, you know, and they go to Premier League and say, excuse me, you let Cavani wear 7, and now Ronaldo's wearing 7. Well, here's the England captain. He wants 9. You know, so that's how it's going to change. And all Arsenal can do is stand and watch. You know, and, you know, any sense of, well, any guidance or any bar you have for Mikel Arteta now has to be adjusted. Because now he doesn't have to beat City and Chelsea and United and Liverpool. Now he has to beat City and Chelsea and United and Liverpool and Newcastle.
Yeah,
and Newcastle have more money than 4 teams other combined.
Well, it's also the fact that there are, you know, Arsenal status as Arsenal are the third most successful team in the country. Historically, they're probably generally financially have been in the top 3 or 4 for most of their history in terms of potential, whether they've utilised that potential otherwise. But now, you know, this puts us outside the top four in terms of maximum spend, in terms of our maximum spending capacity is still outside the average spending capacity of at least four teams in this league, possibly five, depending on what happens with the commercial evolution of, say, Liverpool. And it's a sort of situation where the optimistic view, I suppose, is to take that this will precipitate some long overdue change, because you're getting to a point where, you know, even in the sort of first 15 years of the Premier League, there was always the hope that if you got a good coach and a right mix of players, you could win the league. And Leicester City were the last hurrah for that. They were the kind of, we thought that dream was dead, and Leicester City proved us wrong. But now things have moved on again, and it's gonna be a point where probably you're going to get to a situation where it's going to take so many stars to align for anyone other than three or four clubs to win the Premier League, and anyone other than about six or seven clubs to win the Champions League.
Yeah. And I'm not sure we're one of them.
No, at the moment we're outside looking in.
Which is madness.
And the only thing that keeps us in the discussion is our historical size and status, and which gives us a massive global fan base. And at the moment, we, just like Spurs are trying to do, and certainly, you know, maybe even Liverpool to a point, once their cycle is passed, as it seems to be slightly at the top, the downward curve of the from the peak of the parabola. It's all about positioning. It's all about making sure that you're in the top, as you say, 15 or 20, come whatever happens next, because something's going to happen next, because this has hastened whatever change will happen. And whether it's the European Super League, or whether it's opening up more Champions League places for the Premier League, given the comparative strength of the league, because you look at the other leagues, you've got PSG who've bought France. Yes, they didn't win the league last year, and that was hilarious, but that, you know, they're finishing first or second every year. And you know, if they want to, they're trying to appear to be playing by the rules now, but are they going to continue doing that when Newcastle are throwing money at things? Maybe they're going to go back to being fast and loose again. You've got Germany, where basically everyone is Bayern Munich's bitch for whatever reason that is. It is partly financial, but it isn't purely financial. It's almost as if the system's set up to help Bayern. I've never quite understood why other teams are so compliant to assisting Bayern. But anyway, that's another matter. You've got Spain, where Barcelona, you know, they're desperately hoping that some of the great young players they've got turn into the next Wunder team. Otherwise, they're screwed for a decade. You've got Real Madrid, who are just about limping on, but they're going to have to suddenly start being smart, which they haven't had to need to be for a very long time. Atletico are just laughing, going, oh my God, we don't even spend that much money, and here we are. You've got Italy, where you've got Juventus are going through a bit of a downward patch. But Inter Milan, who are great at the moment, but they've spent all the money. They don't have any money left. And nobody else in Italy has got any money at the moment.
Yeah.
And then the Premier League is going to literally have six, probably, of the best 10 teams in the world. And that's going to be really tricky for new UEFA to try and navigate, particularly given the impact of the pandemic has only accentuated that. And those British teams, the financial means, they're only going to get comparatively stronger compared to the rest, apart from maybe one or two in each country who are clinging on. A change will be inevitable, because that's what the Super League was about. It was about the big clubs wanting to protect themselves against losing their big status against the backdrop of everything going tits up elsewhere. And then suddenly you've dropped this bomb into things. And they're sure as hell, they're thinking, well, what else is going to happen? We can't continue to compete with wage inflation with these guys, because we'll bankrupt ourselves, even though we are like the 10 biggest clubs in the history of world football with the greatest incomes. We still can't compete. What's interesting is how this is going to be covered and how it has been covered. Obviously, Sky have been, how can we put it? Investigative as you'd expect from Sky. In other words, it's someone bringing the Premier League more money. It's the Premier League. We protect it. The European Super League was evil because we didn't control that. the Premier League, we're the Premier League broadcaster, so it's brilliant, whatever happens. We're going to get even more big players coming to the Premier League, which is going to give us even more money, and it's live. Whereas, you know, it'd be interesting to see how people with a slightly less vested interest choose to report this. I mean, obviously not The Guardian, because they're going to be approaching it from what we'll talk about in a minute, the sort of more humanitarian side of things and the more community side of things. But for people who are slightly more in the centre of the spectrum, who, you know, don't have an automatic reason to be against, but certainly don't stand to gain, that's going to be very revealing. And, you know, we're certainly not going to see any of the level of pressure that killed the Super League in 3 days flat. But what's the reaction going to be? At the moment, everyone's just gone, shit.
Yeah. And look, the morale side, the morality side of it, it's very, very, very grey in a sport that very much likes to turn its back on
anything
morality issues when it suits it. You know, like,
remarkably bad at finding dodgy transfer deals for a sport in which there must be millions of dodgy transfer deals.
Yeah, like, and you can go back to anything. You know, like, if you want to talk other clubs, fine. If you want to talk Arsenal, you can talk about the fact that a lad who was convicted of drink driving has a statue outside his stadium. You know, like, there's, you know, a manager that took bongs, etc. Like, it's...
We have to say there's degree.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's my point.
Yeah.
And look, I am not... But this is the problem. You cannot equivocate drink driving to chemically castrating someone for the so-called crime of being homosexual. Like, that's what this lad's doing. That's what this lad is implementing.
Yes.
You know, and, you know, go to America and ask them what they think of him. And as long as you don't put it in the Washington Post, you're all right. Like, it's... This man is literally using Newcastle to make himself look better. It is as simple as that. And are you okay with it? And you said this at the start. Do you blame a Newcastle fan for finally thinking that it's going to be his turn to be able to sing about his club being the best when he's been in the same pub as we've all been in and, you know, being laughed at by United fans or Liverpool fans or Chelsea fans or City fans because our club is 15th and their club is first? No, I do not blame you at all for thinking, right, this is my turn. But Christ, at this price, it's easy for us to be able to stand on the outside and say, oh yeah, we'd walk away.
I mean, it's that thing of, it depends on how we're all sports fans are better at most than this. We're all fantastic at compartmentalizing. And it will really be a test of how successful, once the dust settles and the excitement dies down, how successful Newcastle fans will be at compartmentalizing. Because, you know, we've talked, as I say, before about other regimes and the Emirates, as we said in an earlier podcast, number 164, if you want to go back. You know, Joe Adele came on from the Campaign for Human Rights in UAE. And, you know, it was like, this is pretty grim. You know, we knew about some of it. But this is a whole different level. I mean, you know, just to go for, you know, for a top 10, this is just on Amnesty International, right? Top 10 ways that Saudi Arabia violates human rights.
Do, 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 do.
I mean, yeah, exactly. I mean, this is not for legal purposes. This is not me expressing a personal opinion. This is Amnesty International. But yes, torture is used as a punishment, just as a standard thing in Saudi Arabia. Public flogging is perfectly common. 300 lashes for a Filipino domestic worker. Of course, these punishments always tend to be slightly more sizable for people who aren't Saudi. Amputations, cross amputations are fairly common. Executions, we like quite a lot of public executions in Saudi Arabia, so that's quite fun. Free speech is obviously our survey said, and that's without even getting onto the obviously incredibly well reported case of the journalist who was enticed to the Saudi embassy to pick up his passport so he could get married, only to find himself killed and cut into lots of small pieces at the direct order of the person who chairs this public investment fund. Of course, protests, if any sort of demonstrations should come along that, and that's imprisonment and perhaps more of the torture. Female discrimination, well, we all know about that, women have to be subordinate, but hey, they're allowed to drive now, so everything's fine. Suddenly that's their big kind of publicity winning policy of like finally letting women have one right they have in almost every other country in the world. Torture and police custody, that's just standard. It's actually part of procedure a lot of the time. Detaining and arresting, you don't need to have a reason for doing that. Activists get obviously detained for years without any trial or charge. Religious discrimination, you better be the right sort of Muslim, or otherwise you can get death sentences. And migrant workers, they get turned up and then deported before they can get paid. That happens a lot. In 2013, I think 370,000 of them were deported, except for the ones that were imprisoned without charge. And human rights organizations are banned. And that's just like the basic stuff. That's without even getting into, God help you if you're not heterosexual as well.
But apart from that, he's not that bad.
And as you say, the fact that this is clearly such a calculated act to try and sort of airbrush some of that is something. I mean, I suppose the question is no one can tell a group of people or individuals how they should feel about something. But there are going to be a lot of people that are at some stage, whether it's now or later, are going to feel very conflicted. I mean, what happens if you're, you know, a female homosexual Newcastle fan? How are you supposed to feel at this point? Yeah, you might be excited for your club, but how long are you going to be able to separate yourself from the fact that your club is owned by people who would be quite happy to put you to death? And even if they felt like being particularly lenient, they just wouldn't let you have any rights because you're a woman. That's serious fucking shit, guys. You know, this is a whole different level. You know, people complain about Stan Kroenke, and the worst is that basically he's a bit of a business shark. You know, pissed around St. Louis Rams, and may not be the best with paying his taxes, you know, in terms of volunteering to pay as many taxes as he could, just like every other billionaire businessman in the world. But this is, you know, and that's something for fans to baffle with, but also the authorities, you know. By approving this, the Premier League have basically said that there are no rules, you know, unless you individually have been convicted of certain crimes, go for your life.
Yeah.
Which is, it cannot just happen without there being some sort of reaction. Ultimately, we don't know what the reaction is going to be, and it's far too early to speculate about that at the moment, but that there is going to be some consequence for that. And whether that's, as I said at the start, you know, other states thinking, oh, well, jobs are good and all you have to do is buy a Premier League club and you can make yourself look better. Or is it that, you know, it'll get to the point where, you know, how also depends on how successful these states are at keeping these funds separate. I mean, and the idea of it being separate from the Saudi royal family is a farce, because everything in Saudi is connected to the same family of not that many people. And if you're a member of that family or married into that family and you don't quite follow the party line, you disappear. And that's even if you're a member of the royal family. So you know damn well that nothing's going to happen without the approval of, you know, two or three people.
Yeah.
And that's ultimately what it comes down to. So the Premier League's pathetic excuse that this is a separate entity doesn't fool anyone. I mean, it's disgust. It actually physically disgusts me. You know, you can say If you're going to take the money, just fucking own up to it. You know, if you're going to say that it's fine, just say that we do not think that football and politics should you know, they should be kept separate. And we do not think that these things should really come into it, or whatever, you know, whatever meaning of statement you can say about that. But own it. You know, don't try and, again, it's the legal technicality thing. It's, well, it's not technically the same people, even though the person in charge is the same person. It beggars belief. And it sort of puts all the other controversies that we sort of just discussed in the past into the shade to such a vast degree. You know, it's one of the most appalling regimes in the world using English football to make itself look better while simultaneously potentially completely destroying the competitive landscape of European football.
Yep.
And it's okay, guys. That's cool.
Like, yeah, because the check cleared.
Yeah. Which again makes you think a bit like the World Cup in Qatar. Who else is benefiting from this and how?
And that's the, like I said, that's why it's disgusting to you and it's depressing to me. It's the inevitability of it. Like, we know this is going to work. Like, we know that this is going to, like, they have weaponized Newcastle United. Plain and simple. They now have a legion of fans who is going to defend them to the hilt solely because of a blank checkbook. And again, I don't blame the fans for it. The fans shouldn't be the ones put into that moral quandary of being told, well, you have to decide between supporting your club and not, because the person that owns your club is a piece of shit. It's like, well, hang on a minute. You're the lad who owns your club's a piece of shit. Yeah, well, yours is different. Oh, yeah, of course it is. Yeah.
Like, but it's also who you support, you know, is a fundamental part of your identity.
Exactly.
And now, if you're a Newcastle fan for 60 years, you can't just say, oh, poof, I'll stop feeling anything about that.
Yeah. I want to be owned by a billionaire, but not that billionaire. It's not how it works. You know, there is no good billionaire. You know, maybe there is, but they're not going to get into football because they know better. And it's just it's the naked ambition of it. It's the blatancy of it. It's like, again, Abramovich, when he comes in, well, Jesus, why is this Russian billionaire wanting to spend hundreds of millions in Chelsea? Ah, yes, because he's not allowed within an hour's draw of Moscow. That's why. He's hiding in London. He's giving himself something to do on a Saturday. Literally. Like, yeah. We can joke.
Also, everyone knows who he is now, so they're not going to bump him off.
Yeah, which is why he's not allowed back to Britain, which hilariously. But Man City then come in and say, oh, I've got an idea. Well, you know, let's invest in Manchester City. Let's create an avenue for our investment. Let's create a second PR valve. You know, let's create a separate identity for ourselves outside of what people know. And it worked. And then Qatar went, oh, we can do that. But the price of Premier League clubs is a bit rich. I know what we'll do. We'll buy Paris. Yeah. You know, that's a sexy town. That's a, you know, people who want to live there will buy that for peanuts, throw as much money as we can into it, and build that name up. Has that worked? Yep. So the Saudis, they're looking at this and go, right, what's the blueprint? Right, page one, buy a Premier League club. Well, what's the one with the most hated owner? Oh, Newcastle. B, build up the state. I mean, it's a 52,000-seater stadium. Okay, C, build up a fan base. Oh, wait, it's really well-supported. The club is literally built. The football club is in the town. You know, the top of the town. 99% of towns in the world, what's on top? What's on the biggest hill? A church. In Newcastle, it's St. James's. You know, you go up the town. You go up the hill to church on a Saturday. It's in Newcastle. It's St. James's. And so are you going to have to convince anyone that you're a good man in Newcastle? Nope. Why? Because you're not Mike Ashley.
Yeah.
So you crucially, the red cap is let out for you.
But also PSG, Man City, Newcastle, you know, Chelsea to a degree. It's the teams who are underachieving. You can get them more cheaply, but also you're not going to take the same heat. You're not going to get the opposition. If Saudi Arabia wanted to buy Man United, that's a whole, you know, okay. One, they take no credit if they turn them into being successful because they've done that already. There's a whole lot of scrutiny coming up on that to a far greater degree.
But if they bought Manchester United, I think actually it'd be the opposite. I think if they bought Manchester United and said, with the public investment fund And they said, we're buying Manchester United because if we don't put a penny into it more, they're going to make 120 million a year. I don't think anyone bats an eyelid. I think everyone looks at that and goes, that's probably decent business, actually. You know, if they even if they don't decide to, if Bin Salman comes out and he says, look, I'm not running this team. I'm standing nowhere near it. I'm leaving, you know, Ed Woodward and that in charge. I'm not touching it. But what I am doing is I'm paying off the loan and I'm leaving it to itself. And whatever profits it makes, it gets reinvested in the team. That's it. That's all I'm doing. I think this is a worthwhile investment and a valuable addition to my portfolio. End of. I think no one bats an eyelid. I really do. It's the fact that...
So why do you think they've only bought clubs who are underachieving
Because then it's their club.
Exactly. That's my point.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
That's my point, because Man United are already one of the biggest clubs in the world, one of the most successful clubs in the world.
Yeah.
Anything they do wrong gets greater scrutiny because they're not the saviour. That, you know, in the scenario you outlined, they're a bit of a saviour, but they're only by virtue of being a bit better than the shitheads over there currently.
Yeah.
But they're not transforming anything really. They're just they're augmenting.
Yeah. Well, look, that's why Rafa Benitez went to Newcastle. He wins one trophy there, he's a god.
Yeah, yeah.
One, whether it be a League Cup or an FA Cup, a god in Newcastle, you know, because he's just won something. Yeah. Like, and the first trophy Newcastle wins, they'll be, you know, they're not going to be singing Fog of the Tyne on Hymen and Mine in Riyadh on a Saturday at night, but they'll be singing Saudi songs in Newcastle. Like, it's just one of those ones where it's like, I don't expect the fans to be the moral guardians of the sport, because fans like ourselves will use almost any argument to justify the fact that we support this club as opposed to yours.
Well, there's also, there's the tribalism. There's also two other things. It's the fact that fans, A, have no power. That's been shown to us repeatedly again and again and again, that unless every fan of every club unites, fans can't influence a damn thing. You know, otherwise they wouldn't be made to be driving up to the opposite end of the country on a Monday night to go and watch something because Sky have decided that they've got a free slot. But secondly, there's also the fact that, you know, you cannot get a unified view and you cannot get any sort of cohesive approach of governance from a disparate group of individuals who are... They're only united by a couple of things. Everything, you know, they're so trying to coagulate that into something cohesive to be in opposition to something is incredibly difficult, unless it's being in opposition to something whose identity is defined in the same terms. You know, they can oppose Sunderland.
Yeah.
But even then, you know, that would be incredibly difficult to achieve because everyone would feel slightly differently about it. I mean, and one other thing that we have to comment on this is, isn't it illuminating that European Super League happened? We had all kinds of politicians commenting. This has happened. Hello? Hello?
No, no, like yeah.
And is anybody what? There? It might be because we're currently selling a shitload of arms to the Saudis.
But to the point that, you know, the information that, you know, the British government gave to the Premier League on whether the British government are insisting that be kept classified.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Of course, it's going to be very interesting the next time there is a Saudi-funded terror attack in Europe, how that's going to pan out. But anyway.
Can we just start? Can we, like, wrap this up just by talking about Katie McCabe's ability to score from 30 yards?
I was about to say, we've kind of talked as much as we can about this issue, except as there was one other thing I want to talk about on this just before we wrap up. We've talked about the morality, we've talked about potential long-term impacts. Does this mean that this season is the last season we can expect to beat Newcastle home and away?
Yeah, maybe. Not expect, but, I mean, like I said, it changes the dynamic of how you see Arsenal Football Club. It just does, because now you've got another team that can outspend you anytime, anywhere. And as a result, you have to judge players and judge managers accordingly.
And also perhaps change what you feel is a realistic aspiration accordingly as well.
Yeah, and look, this is from the top down. Like, does Stan Kroenke now see his investment as valuable as it was yesterday?
Yeah.
Because now it's not a certainty that Arsenal are a top four club anymore.
Yeah.
You know, so like it's literally from there down. Like this will affect thousands of people in the industry just because Newcastle are now more valuable than maybe anyone. It means that Leicester's valuation goes down. Tottenham's valuation goes down. Arsenal's valuation goes down. Why does it go down? Because there's less chance of them being a top four Champions League club, maybe in the Super League. Because if they do set up a Super League and it's still only 18 clubs and it's six from England, you're not leaving Newcastle out.
Hmm.
So, you know,
it'd be very funny if they did.
No. That could start a war.
Yes, indeed. Well, a bit like, what was it, El Salvador against whoever it was in the 70s, where they briefly had a war sparked by the World Cup. We also have to, you know, also mention, I think one thing about the moral quandaries about this for both, and this applies to Qatar and the Emirates as well, that we have to mention that it's not just that there's vast amounts of money being used by horrible regimes to cover up what they're doing, but this is state money.
Mm.
This is when you actually think about it, they're stealing from their people to protect their own personal reputations, to be able to prop up horrendous regimes that will allow them to continue stealing from their people. And that is that's a head fuck, really. So, on to more cheerful things, because we can't fix... It's a bit like, you know, third Middle Eastern peace or hunger in the third world. You know.
It's the beautiful game, et cetera, isn't it?
Yes. Well, to try and find some beauty within it, which of course we will all continue to do because it is an obsession that affects our lives far more than is sensible. Yes, as you alluded to, Arsenal women had a splendid 3-0 victory against Everton women today, with Miss McCabe once again showing her propensity for absolute bangers.
We mean goals.
Yes, talk us through it.
I mean, it was Letizia-esque. On her left foot, chests it, lobs it over the keeper from 30 yards in a volley style. Unbelievable goal. And it's getting harder and harder to justify leaving her. I know she's did a regular anyway, but it's like there's so much talent in that squad now.
Mm.
You know, and that's before Tobin Heath coming in and coming, oh yeah, I'm an Arsenal fan for life, but she is. Can I play? And we're like, yes. I mean, first off, yay, you're one of the best forwards in the world. Happy days. B, we kind of got a lot of front right now, but yeah, here, sit down there. We'll try and squeeze you in here somehow. Like, it's such a magnificent...
You might have like to step up for occasionally gubbing Spurs in the cup. How's that?
Yes. We've gone from complaining, I suppose complaining might be wrong, but pointing out that Newcastle have an unfair advantage over nearly every other club in the league by being able to buy whoever we want. And now we're giving out about the fact that we can't squeeze Tobin feckin' Heath into our women's team.
Mm.
You know, so we have to be a little bit careful about it. But yeah, it's just a show of strength of where Arsenal are right now. Where, yes, Barcelona, you know, spanking them 4-1 in the Champions League wasn't great, but Barcelona are so far ahead of everyone else right now, it's insane.
Mm.
But then Arsenal can come back and thrash nearly everyone, you know, beating City 5-0. They can beat anyone in the league here. So like it's a sense of where Eichfeld wants them to be, where they're scoring more from set pieces, they're playing a very attractive style of football. They're good, they're getting places, and that's without having to rely on the best number nine in the world to get them out of trouble every game. It's rather encouraging.
Yeah, he's taken, you know, the basis that Joe Montemurro built and has added a greater dynamism and sort of I suppose physical demands, so they play this higher tempo pressing, you know, to coin the phrase, you know, rock and roll football, and it is very attractive. I mean, it's sort of quite inspiring in a way to see the levels to which they're performing. But again, you know, making the parallel, let's not forget that Arsenal women are to English women's football what Manchester United wish they were to men's football.
Mm.
This is a team that has been the best for most of its history, and certainly one of the best for all of its history. And it's not as if they've gone out and, you know, totally transformed the playing staff overnight. You know, this is a combination of, this is some very strong additions to something that's been built over a period of time, which is also great, which is, you know, you've got that combination of some new excitement, but also, you know, as per Mertesacker, I would say those lovely automatisms that are in place there as well. And, you know, the very close group of players, you know, socially as well as on the sporting side, which can only help as well. And yeah, and it is great that at a time when money's a bit tight, to mention that the Arsenal board took the decision to support slightly increase their support to the ladies team, as opposed to withdrawing it as happened at some other clubs. And recognizing the growth and the impact of women's football. And that's something we have to congratulate the people running the club on. Because we've seen other women's teams, you know, in the Premier League. I mean, Man United didn't have a women's team until about 3 years ago, and that they've thrown a fair money out. There was other women's teams that, you know, Liverpool's women's team had a shitload of their investments and they withdrawn after they did very well for a couple of years. And that's not something that's happened at Arsenal. And we have to celebrate that, because it shows a commitment to excellence at women's football, which is also reflected within the Arsenal Women's Academy as well, which is sadly keeps producing players that then go off and play for other clubs because they can't get in the Arsenal Women's first team. But, you know, it's showing a commitment that goes beyond just a temporary engagement, but a sort of longer term view. I mean, we've got a way to go before we match Aulos at Lyon and his commitment to women's football, but still, nonetheless, it's very, very, very encouraging indeed. Last thing I wanted to mention before we wrap up is just how funny is it to see Belgium continuing to be the Spurs of international football, full of promise.
We can make all the jokes about, you know, doormats and Second World War and all that, but like, it's a Roberto Martinez team. It's a team that plays really pretty football and then gets a lead, and then as soon as the shit hits the fan, so do they. Like, you saw it against France. You know, 2-0 up, cruising, and then France score one, team with five at the back, and they're going, oh, what are we going to do here? But, you know, giving up a 91st-minute winner. They're hugely talented, more talented than England, that which is saying something, and no backbone, no heart, nothing in them to make them say they're going to fight. And it's mad that team is going to go away and win nothing with De Bruyne and Hazard and Vertonghen and Alderweireld and etc. And they're going to come away with nothing.
What's mad is the fact that none of us are surprised.
Yeah.
You get people saying, oh, Belgium, dark horse. And it's more than a dark horse. You look at the quality of the players, but we're also thinking they're not going to win. They don't have the mentality. They're like the opposite of, if say the Italians or the Germans, who are just kind of like, winning is everything, and we will do whatever we need to do to try and make that happen. And, you know, obviously German teams had a talent imbalance or a slight shortfall of talent in certain positions in recent years, but they'll come strong again. And we've seen the Italians, you know, went from nowhere to being unbeaten in 4 years, and despite not having a squad with nearly as much talent as most of the top teams in Europe. Ever since Vertonghen and Alderweireld went to Spurs, I always think of Belgium as being Spursy, and so it has proved once more. Looking forward to the game tonight. Should be a good one.
Literally on my way to the pub now.
Ah, good man. In which case, I shan't keep you any longer because your pub journey time is starting to get very slim. So thank you for getting this far, listeners, if you have. I hope this hasn't been too heavy all the way through, but we thought it was important to talk about it, particularly as we've talked about related issues on this podcast before, and also because it is something which is going to have a massive impact on both us as Arsenal fans, but also perhaps as football obsessives in general. Thank you, Stephen, for lending your wisdom to this discussion.
No, any time. And like I said, just before we go, I have to thank everyone who is either supported, watched, or even subscribed to the Daily Cannon YouTube channel, which has been going thanks to my tactics board videos for the last 9 months or so. Just broke 1,000 subs. cannot thank you enough for all the support, you know, whether it be, you know, you're just a single viewer watching on a regular basis, whether you've come to here or there from the r/Gunners Reddit page, just so many people being supportive and interested in having a grown-up conversation about tactics in general and football and where Arsenal are. You know, where like I can scroll down after a video after 10, 12 hours and there's 20, 30 people talking there with espousing their views and no one is swearing, no one is abusing anyone, no one is disrespecting everyone. They're just having a nice conversation. It's so nice to see, and I cannot thank any of you enough for, you know, showing it, you know, gobshite like me, a little bit of faith in watching our videos. But now that we have, you know, broken a couple of thresholds, we will be able to, you know, start, you know, making new content on Daily Cannon. We'll be able to start, you know, live streaming. We'll be able to start bringing, you know, live podcasts, live, you know, live watch-alongs, videos on a regular basis, whether it be youth reviews or as ever. So, yeah, the sky's the limit, and we can only thank you for that. So, thanks very much.
And also thank you to all of us who follow the Daily Cannon on Twitter. It's always great being able to interact, and whether that's with the Daily Cannon account or even our individual accounts, I'm always up for a bit of discussion about such matters on Twitter. We've got the @DailyCannon, where you can get me at Lomekian, Lomekian. I don't know if Stephen wants himself added, but we'll add him in the podcast description.
Yeah. Oh, no, I love the publicity. I'm fine.
You heard it here first. Okay, well, have a wonderful week, everyone. Next time we speak to you, it'll probably be after the next time Arsenal plays, which might put our schedule slightly out of kilter. But you might hear something before then, if there's anything else seismic that happens in the football world between now and then. Anyway, have a great week, everyone, and we'll speak to you on the other side. Cheerio.
Good luck.